Hello, everyone. Welcome to Digital Media E10. This is week six, the histogram. So first, before we dive into some of this, which is actually really fascinating, I think, and I'm really looking forward to talking about it, there's a few reminders that I want to go through. First of all, Project 2 is due tonight at 11:59 p.m. Eastern. Problem Set 3 is due next week. And as you've probably been able to tell, the pattern recently, and this will persist for the duration of the course, is that the problem sets are, of course, a little bit more theoretical. They tend to take a bit less time than the projects, or at least the hope is that you're spending a lot more time on the projects than you are on the problem sets. And so it's a little bit of a breather, perhaps, in that regard. Then Project 3 was just released a little bit, couple of hours ago, and you can go look at that on the course website. I want to just spend a little bit of time talking about it, because very much like the Project 1 and Project 2, it is very different from all of the other projects. So Project 1 asks you to go out and identify shapes in an environment. Project 2 asks you to put some effort into actually capturing a photograph, whether that's manufacturing something, spending a lot of time actually constructing a scene in some way, or something along those lines. Project 3, and this makes me a little nervous, Project 3 is a collaborative effort. So in groups of two or three, you're basically going to be editing other people's images. So there's essentially two parts. There's really three parts, but there's the bulk of this project is essentially split into two parts. In the first, you independently take 100 photographs. This can be of whatever. There's some guidelines that you should review in the project specification itself, but essentially you're taking 100 photographs of relative uniqueness and supplying them to another person in your group. Now, this other person is then the editor, and the editor will go ahead and edit all of those photographs. And so this is the second part of the project. So in your group of two or three people, you will each take 100 photographs of whatever, totally independently. You'll exchange images, or if you're in a group of three, you'll sort of pass from person A to person B the photos, person B will give to person C, and so on, just sort of circular, so that everybody else edits somebody else's photographs, and then you'll also edit all of those photos. And the point of this is to take somebody else's body of work, whittle it down, so to take all of those 100 images, identify five of the best ones, and actually perform software modifications to them to try to make it the best that those photographs can actually be. So this was actually motivated a little bit by my own annoyance, frankly, with editing my own photographs. One of the things that I noticed was that I would take a lot of photographs, dump them into Aperture, now Lightroom, go through them, do a selection process, and end up with maybe, I don't know, 5% or 10% of the images that I started out with. But I really wasn't sure which of those, even though they were very similar perhaps, or some of them would be somewhat similar, I couldn't decide between which of the two I really wanted to pick. So I would end up asking anybody, friends or family or coworkers, whatever, what do you think of these two images? And most of the time they'd be like, they look the same, I don't care, whatever. And that would kind of point out to me, oh man, this one detail that I think is really important to the photograph perhaps isn't quite so important. So maybe the thing that matters more in the case of this hypothetical example is the focus or the exposure or something along those lines, even though I might think that one of them is better. And so what this is meant to do is to provide that feedback for you automatically. So whereas we've been able to critique each other's photos in the blog, we haven't really been able to see sort of the raw output of each other's photographic work. And that's kind of the point of this, is to take somebody else's body of photographs, 100 photos or more. You can decide to do more if you want, and you can decide that amongst your group, but have a minimum of 100 and whittle it down to five. Pick the five that you think are best and edit those to be the best. And so even though this is a collaborative project, I don't want you to think that that is sort of the main part of it. The main part of this is your independent work, first capturing those 100 photographs and supplying them to your editor, and then taking somebody else's photographs and the work that you do on those. So that's really the bulk of the grading for this project. But of course, there is this collaborative effort, and so do be aware that at the very end of the project, after you've actually done all of these things, there is a survey that you can find at the very end of the project specification that basically asks you to rate your own performance and to rate the performance of the others in your group. That's just to make sure that we're all sort of along the same lines, and that will contribute a little bit to the grade. just as a motivating factor to make sure that you communicate well with the other people in your group and get them the 100 photographs with enough time for them to be able to edit them. So, like other projects, you have 2 weeks to do this. So I highly suggest if you're sitting here in class, if you're watching the live stream and in the chat room, just start, especially during the break, start chatting with each other and try to get a group of two or three people. Introduce yourself, get to know one another. Other venues, you could go to section, either the in-person section or the online sections. We're giving you time this week and next week to sort of, well, really should have group, hopefully by the end of this week. You will have time to form a group and do that. If you still have trouble, ask on the blog, and you can suggest your public email address, the one that you don't mind sharing, and other people will be able to contact you. You can have a group larger than two or three, but I don't really think it'll work well if you have a group much larger than, say, about four or five. We don't want it to be a big circle, so just be sure that you sort of end up with two or three people in a group. If by this coming weekend you still don't have a group, email the staff and we will pair you up manually. This is, again, all in the project specification. And please do be sure to read this specification in its entirety. There's a lot of additional constraints that I haven't actually mentioned here that are important with regard to the 100 photographs that you take and the editing that you will actually that you'll do on someone else's photos. So I'm excited about this. In the past that we've done this, we have had, you know, one or two groups that have difficulty. But for those of you that are at a distance, I don't think this is necessarily going to be a disadvantage because there are a lot of online tools that you can use to actually share your photographs with each other. One of the most common ones, perhaps, is Dropbox. And Dropbox would be a great way for you to share photographs with each other. Dropbox does have space limitations. We provide some tips and tricks that you can try to do to work with this project, even outside or even within the scope of these limitations. So do take a look at the project spec. And don't wait too long, because you really will want to have a group and get this started as quickly as possible. Any questions on this before we move on? OK, great. And just like in the past with the existing problem sets and projects, this will all be due on the submission tool, which you can find on the course website, except the survey. The survey is a separate Google-based form, which you will submit by the time this project is due. OK, so histograms. So really, a histogram is a very simple concept. Basically, it's just a graph that shows us the number of times that we count a particular thing. It's basically just a count of various things. So for example, let's say that we have this histogram, which I pulled off Wikipedia because it's just such a lovely example. It's just a very simple, lovely example of what a histogram actually is, which is a distribution of heights of black cherry trees. So we have some population of cherry trees, and they all have a specific height. And we're basically counting the frequency, or counting the occurrence of those heights, perhaps doing some rounding in this particular case. So we can see here that between height 60 and 65, we have three trees. Between height 70, 65 and 70, we have three trees. 70 to 75, it starts getting a lot bigger, to 9, and so on and so forth. So really, this is just counting frequency, or the number of occurrences that we actually have of some particular thing in a population of something. So in the context of digital photographs, a histogram is counting the tones, all of the tones from black to white. So how many pixels, and you can really think of this in terms of the pixels that make up the image representing a digital photograph, how many pixels are fully black? How many pixels are fully white? How many pixels are sort of a middle gray, or perhaps a 75% gray? And that's really what the histogram is showing us. So that's it, right? Histograms, we're done, we can call it a day, go home. Not quite, unfortunately. There's a lot of additional complexity to this that you'll actually see in just a few moments. So let's take a look at a couple of really simple histograms. This is just a histogram from a representative image. I don't even remember which one I pulled this from. But you can sort of see that there's a wide array of tonal range within this image. There's a fair amount of dark tones, there's a fair amount of mid-tones. There's a fair amount of not quite so, I mean, it's pretty bright, but not super bright tones. And then you can see there's a little bit of a spike at the very high end of the tonal range up here. But what would it look like if we have an image that is completely black? So within this white square, we have an image that is so totally underexposed that every single pixel is black. We get a corresponding histogram that looks like that. It's just a peak. It's just a single line at the absolute lowest portion of the histogram, all the way to the left, representing the value 0, representing the black tones within this image. And we get just that single spike. And likewise, if we have something that's so completely overexposed, we get the opposite. We see all of the white pixels that make up this image are represented in the histogram right here. So what does it actually look like to see an image with a well-exposed histogram? Well, realize that the tones can vary a great deal in a scene, and therefore the histogram itself will actually vary a great deal, even though we might have several different types of histograms that are representative of a well-exposed photograph. So in this case, I would argue this photograph is well-exposed. It's all of the tones are sort of in the middle range. As you can see here, there's perhaps a peak sort of to the left of the middle in this slightly darker range. It's kind of tricky, though, to identify which portions, perhaps, of the image are actually making up this aspect of the histogram. What is that peak actually representing? But there's a few things that I want to mention before we actually start talking about why that peak exists in that particular location. One of them is that the histogram is an extremely, extremely useful tool as you're taking digital photos. When you take a photo and you look at the photo on the back of your screen, on the back of your camera, you might think that it looks very well exposed based on the representation of that photo on the screen. But perhaps you go home later, and this still happens to me even now. I put it on my computer and I realize, oh, it's not properly exposed. There's some aspect, because the screen is actually illuminated, if you're in a dark area, if you're in a dark scene and you capture a photo and you look at the photo on the screen, because the screen is illuminated, it can make it look brighter than it actually is. Likewise, if you're outside and it's very bright, even though the screen is illuminated, it may not be super bright, and so it may actually look darker than it is, and you may trend to overexpose outside in the middle of the day or underexpose when it's darker. So using the histogram is sort of a tool that we can use to try to figure out if our tones are properly exposed, if our tones properly fit within the range of our photograph. And that is pretty easy to do when the tones do fit precisely within the range that our camera is capable of capturing, as is the case here. We can see that there's perhaps a little bit of these really dark tones and these really bright tones. These are those horizontal lines that exist on the left and the right side of this particular histogram. But the bulk of our tones exists right in the middle. And so we can reasonably assume that our photograph is properly exposed in this case. So the main takeaway here is that you should not rely on the back LCD of your camera just by itself to determine whether or not an image is properly exposed. In fact, many of you have probably already learned this as you work on Project 1 and Project 2. You might have taken a photo, put it on your computer, and realized, oh, it's for some reason it just seems so improperly exposed. And it is because of this reason. So enable the histogram on your camera, and you'll have a clue. But there's a lot more detail here that we need to go into. In particular, histograms aren't necessarily going to have, no, let me rephrase that. The tones that exist within a scene aren't necessarily going to fit precisely within the histogram of your image. Another way of saying this is that we might have a lot of really dark tones and a lot of really light tones in a scene that are just not possible for our camera to capture. So those will end up being either totally dark or totally white, respectively. And as a result, we'll have these spikes in our histogram in either the low or the high regions that represent these particular tones. And this can kind of throw off our mental calculation of whether or not our image is properly exposed. So all of these histograms are in fact representative of the images that are being shown, but we can see that even though these images are arguably properly exposed, the histograms differ a great deal. They're actually very different from one image to the next. And so again, I would argue, well, the bulk of these tones are perhaps properly exposed, but it's really a combination of things. We can see that there are some dark regions of the photograph, in particular the very bottom, And that has some detail that may be lost. I don't think there's a lot of detail that's lost in the case of these shadow areas, but there is some. But I would argue that I don't really care about this quite as much as I do the other aspects of this image. As you can tell from this mountain, some areas were getting very, very close to overexposure, particularly in the very center of the scene. So if I were to increase the exposure compensation of this, which would be my initial reaction by looking at this and seeing that I have a huge spike in the dark area, that would indicate to me, okay, I need to increase the exposure compensation on my camera to tell it to allow more light in and therefore push my histogram, this way, to the right. But what that would have the effect of doing is perhaps overexposing some of these areas of the photograph that are more important in this case. So the histogram is a very useful tool, but it by itself is not going to be the one thing that will solve all of your exposure problems, because we do have a wide variety of histograms that can be representative of a well-exposed photograph. So in this photo, we have those areas that do appear like they are becoming overexposed, but is there anything that's purely white based on this histogram? And perhaps what I will do is zoom in on the histogram a little bit so that we can see. Are there any areas that are pure white? So I see a little bit. Are there any nose? So in this case, there is perhaps maybe just a few pixels. The fact that there's like a little smidge of a histogram visible in the far right does indicate that perhaps we do have some overexposed areas. And by that, it may not be a large area that's overexposed, but it might just be, in fact, individual pixels or small clusters of pixels that are very, very close to being overexposed, or in fact, pure white and therefore overexposed. But in this case, and exposure, as you can probably start to tell, is pretty subjective, especially when you have a scene that has a very wide range of tones that you're trying to capture with your image. And so deciding where that proper exposure lies is a little bit of a subjective measure, but there are some rules that we can apply to it. We sort of want it to be overall well exposed so we minimize, in fact, the loss to detail in these overexposed or underexposed areas. So in this case, it took a little bit of fiddling with some software-based exposure values, but I think this was sort of the proper exposure in the end for this particular image. Now, lots of things can have wide tonal ranges. In this case, we can see that even though there are aspects of this photograph that are well exposed, there are areas that are underexposed, in particular this portion underneath the large rock right here, and there are aspects of the scene that are overexposed as well, perhaps like some of the white water here, and perhaps some of the clouds that are actually cut off at the very top of the photograph as well. So there's no histogram formula that makes it right. It's really dependent on the scene that you have, that the exposure that you actually want to pick. But it's important to realize as well that each of these histograms have relative heights. So whereas for the very first histogram that we were showing, which was this example from Wikipedia, we could have a histogram that just keeps growing. If we have another 100 trees, for example, that were between the height of 75 and 80 feet, a histogram for a digital camera fits within the rectangle that you see. So in other words, it has a fixed height. And so if you have one spike in your image, it's going to shrink everything else because it has to fit that huge spike within that same height, and so everything else is going to shrink in order to fit by percentage. And so that's an important thing to realize, is that you might have some histograms that do have a lot of variation in their height overall. And you might have some histograms that seem to be pushed down, like this one, which is really kind of flattened a little bit in the middle, because we have these edges that are very, very high. In particular, we have a lot of pixels that are bright white in this particular histogram. So pay attention to the relative height of this. If you have a spike and you notice that everything else seems to be relatively flat, that could indicate to you that you have more pixels that are overexposed or underexposed than you may want in your image. Or again, perhaps not. Perhaps it is actually properly exposed based on the scene that you want. So just another example, even if we have a scene that's kind of perhaps predominantly a bright color. So in this case, one of the things, the reason that I had this photo here in comparison to this one is that I would have expected a much bigger spike in the very bright end of the histogram of this photograph because there's so much more that's white compared to this one. But there is, in fact, in this image, a lot more variation in that white. It's, in fact, a lot of different changes in that white from white to just slightly darker than white. And you can see that in the texture in the clouds. So the histogram is a very literal interpretation of what is happening in your photograph. And that's important to realize when you're trying to use that to your advantage when adjusting your exposure. So a couple more examples of under and overexposure, which really flattened the histogram a little bit, are these bottles that we showed for low and high key examples to try to eliminate the background entirely by either blowing it out entirely or overexposing it completely, as is the example on the right, or making it totally underexposed and therefore losing all the detail to shadows, as we did on the left. We can see that we were relatively successful in doing this because we got the histograms that we would want. We would want to have very high spikes in the very dark regions of the low-key photograph, thereby pushing down the height of the histogram in all other areas, and doing a likewise thing for the very bright scene, for the high-key, for all the bright pixels in the high-key photo on the right. And you can actually watch your histogram change as you modify the exposure value. So we had this photograph as an example of modifying the exposure compensation on your photo. And you can actually see that this was perhaps one of the best examples of really using the histogram. You might take a photo, and in this case, when I did take this photo, I mean, I already knew that the white sand was going to cause my camera to want to underexpose it a little bit. But I looked at the histogram, and by looking at that, I could realize, wow, there's this huge gap where there's absolutely no bright pixels, even though I know that this sand should, in fact, be white, or at least very bright. And therefore, pushing up the exposure compensation to try to fill that gap with more bright tones was precisely the correct answer in order to get the proper exposure in this scene. Now again, in this scene, I was fortunate that the tonal range, the range of all the tones in the scene do actually fit very well into the capable tonal range of the camera. And so really then, this makes the metering a bit more clear. When we look at the histogram, we can try to decide, based on what we think the scene should look like, how to push the camera's exposure compensation. So far so good, right? This is perhaps the second time that we could call it a day, be like, okay, I get this, this is good. I can go home, I can take a look at my histogram, I will understand what's going on. Well, hold up, don't pack your bags quite yet because again, the devil is in the details. Most of the histograms are actually luminance or luminosity, which is the more correct term, the luminosity histograms. But there are in fact different forms of histograms that tell you different things about your image. So in order to talk about what a luminosity histogram actually is, we have to take a step way back to week one. And you might have thought very early on in week one, why are we talking about bits and bytes? Why are we talking about some of this stuff? This starting with sort of last week and sort of these upcoming weeks, we're starting to tie in to all of these different aspects that we've been talking about in the past few weeks together. And really talking about bits and bytes are going to help us decipher and understand the luminosity histogram in a lot better way. So bits and bytes, we have bits, all of these make up, these are binary representations of numbers, which then all in combination make up our images in that sort of bitmap form. We have a coordinate plane, basically, where every cell has a specific color. So we have a bit, which is either a 0 or a 1, and we have a byte, which is 8 bits. And you might recall way back from the first week that we talked about the different file formats. So JPEG and TIFF and all of those, and how all of those have color information represented by a certain number of bytes that make up the color for every individual pixel location. But actually, just understanding this allows us to understand a little bit more about the histogram itself. So let's go back to that same histogram that we had at the very beginning that showed us a range of tones from black to white. What this actually means is that black is a value of 0, and white is a value of 255. 255, so the range from 0 to 255 is 256 unique numbers. So how many bytes do we need to represent that much data? We have 256 unique values. How many bytes do we need to represent 256 unique values? Any ideas? This might even be a question on problems at 3. Almost. Well, not really. 1. Just 1 byte. Because 1 byte is 8 bits. And each, because every bit is either a 0 or a 1, if you have 8 of them, you're essentially taking 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, 8 times. So 2 to the 8th, that is in fact 256 unique numbers that we can actually then count in our luminance histogram. So far, hopefully this is all making sense. So let's tie this in to some file formats, like JPEG, for example, where we have color information that's split into 3 different channels, the red, the green, and the blue. Each one of those was a byte of information, or 8 bits. So we were saying that for every pixel, we have 24 total bits of information, 3 bytes of information, a third of which represent the red value, a third of which represent the green value, a third of which represent the blue value, and in combination make up all of the colors that our computers can actually display to us. So what does this actually mean? If we were to take this at a very literal interpretation, we would actually have gradients for each of these. If we just looked at the red portion of the JPEG file, we would see that it goes from 0, representing black, all the way up to bright red, representing 255. Same thing for green, same thing for blue. And imagine what would happen if we actually combined each of these various things. So let's say that I have, in an individual pixel, a red component, a green component, and a blue component. If I have 0 for each of these, what color does that make? Zero red, zero green, zero blue. Yep, precisely. We have a black color. Now, what if I turn all of these on? 255, 255 for green, 255 for blue. What color would this represent? White, because we have a presence of all of the illuminated colors, so it would actually appear white to us. So obviously, if I did something like this, 0, 255, and 0, this would be what color? Green. So far, so good. Now let's do something a little more complicated. What about 255 for red, 255 for green, and 0 for blue? Any ideas what color this would make? Green and red. Yellow. Yeah, exactly. So we can have yellow out of that. Green and blue is perhaps a little bit more obvious. It would be more of a cyan color. Cyan. And we can keep going on and on. Red and blue is also somewhat easy to understand. That would be a purple or violet, and so on and so forth. So this really is just the way that we can represent all of the different colors. But obviously, there's a tension here, because the histogram that we've been looking at isn't representative of colors. It's representative of tones from black all the way through all of the grays to white. So there's obviously some component here. Oh, that's a mistake. There's obviously some component here where we want to convert these colors that, in combination, each of the color channels that in combination make up the color representing a pixel, we need to convert it in some way to grayscale. So what would be the easiest thing to do to try to make a single location that has three different bytes of color information into a single byte of color information representing a gray value? I would argue the simplest thing would just be to average them and just see what you get. So this would work relatively well, maybe, because you would get, you would average black to be black, you would average white to be white, you would average something like green to be about a third or so, you would average blue to be about a third, and that's maybe reasonable. This is perhaps an average of each of those color representations above. But I would argue that that is not how our visual system works. In fact, it isn't. Our visual system is comprised of these cone cells that allow us to see color in different intensities. So you might recall that we have 98% of the cones, and if you take the average of all humans, 98% of the cones that make up our visual system is represented by M and L types, or green and red detection. The long type, the S type, the short type, all the way on the left, is reserved for blue, and we have far fewer cones that can actually detect that color. Detection is perhaps not really the correct word. We have fewer cells that would be stimulated by light at that particular wavelength. So imagine something for just a moment. Imagine that we have a room, or rather three separate rooms, that have nothing in them except for a light bulb in each. We have on the far left a room that has a light bulb that's purely red. In the middle we have a room with a light bulb that's purely green. And on the far right we have a room that has a light that is only pure blue. Now imagine that you visit each of these, sort of close your eyes and imagine that you visit each of these rooms independently. Which room would appear to be brightest to you? And just blurt out, there's no wrong answers here. Which one do you think would... Red, green, any other? Let's see if we can get a consensus here. I heard one red, one green. Who thinks red? Let's do it this way. One hand, who thinks green? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Okay, who thinks blue? All right, so the vast majority of you think that it's green, and in fact, in the average human visual perception, that is actually the case. The green light appears to be a much more important aspect to the intensity of the light, to the apparent brightness of the light, than is the red and especially the blue. Now, these are actually converted based on the relative intensity. So these grayscales that you see below the color is representative of the relative intensity that each of these is supposed to be in the quote-unquote average human. But none of us are, of course, average. We're all above average, and so what we see may be slightly different than this. If you sort of imagine that you take these colors and make them grayscale, perhaps they will actually look slightly brighter, slightly darker to you, but this is just meant to be representative of the human visual system as a whole. So we can actually then quantify this. We can actually say that there's components, that there's color components that are more important to the apparent brightness of a pixel than other color components. And in fact, that is what luminosity is actually providing to us. So the way that we perceive luminance is a measure of the brightness of something, how intense the light actually is. Our perception of luminance is in fact luminosity. And the luminosity calculation looks like this. We have about 30% of the brightness value goes to red. 60 or almost 60% of the importance of the color towards the apparent brightness of a color is the green component. And lastly, we have blue, which looks much darker. And in fact, you can still sort of tell on this slide when green is perhaps the most obvious of the colored letters here, because it's the brightest according to our visual system, even though all of the intensities of these colors are identical. So because of the way that you are perceiving the color, the green looks the brightest, even though in reality it isn't. And we alluded very early on to this difficulty that we have in the human visual system, that our perception impacts the way the things look, even though it's not necessarily reality. And this is a very important example of that. So when I was talking about using a luminosity histogram, it is essentially taking the red component, the green component, the blue component of each individual pixel, piping it through this luminosity computation, and getting out an apparent luminosity value. So some grayscale value from 0 all the way up to 255, representing the gray tone that approximates the brightness of that color using this luminosity function. So what this actually means is that we can then go back to those slides that we were looking at before with an image that was completely black and with an image that was completely white. Now we can actually apply some color to it and compute what the histogram would actually look like. So here we have an image that's totally red. It has red at the brightest possible intensity, and we can see the resulting histogram from this image. We see that there is a spike about 30% of the way from the left. And this is precisely because of this luminosity computation that we actually have. If we have a value that's all red, so if we have at the very top leftmost pixel in this image a value of a color value of 255 for red, 0 for green, 0 for blue. I didn't write red here. But imagine that it's 255 for red, 0 for green, 0 for blue. We pump that through our luminosity computation, and we get a value of whatever 30% of 256 is going to be, 50-something or something like that. And that is precisely the pixel location of this histogram. Now, what's really fascinating, I think, maybe it's not fascinating, it makes a lot of sense. If you look at the histogram in an application like Photoshop, the width of this picture right here, the width of the histogram itself is actually 256 pixels, which means that one pixel, one column is devoted to each of these values. Now, that doesn't have to be the case. Obviously, for this, I've had to expand it a little bit, but I tried to do it evenly, tried to make it about 512 or so. But I don't think that's the case for this particular histogram. Anyway, that's just an aside. But anyway, this sort of implies something about histograms. This implies something that what we can actually do is we have some control over, if we were to design a specific image, we could perhaps design a resulting histogram out of that image. So imagine that we kick this up a notch and we have this image here. What I want us to do is to try to compute the luminosity histogram for this image. So I can tell you precisely the size of this image. It's 500 pixels wide and 500 pixels tall. And there's five columns here, so that means that each column has a width of 100 pixels, so 100 pixels for each of these columns. And that means that the height of these half ones are about 250, and the height of these full height ones are in fact 500 pixels. So we can figure out then precisely what our histogram should look like based on this particular image. So let's first look at this at a high level. Which spikes will be the tallest? Which spikes will be the shortest? So what colors will have the spikes that will be the highest in the end for this luminosity histogram? Sorry?
Green.
Green. Green is one, red is another, blue is another. They will all have equal height spikes because in this case we have the same number of pixels that make up the red, the green, and the blue components. And we would have perhaps half height columns for the other colors, white, black, yellow, and cyan. So we can actually draw, without having to do any other computation, we can actually sort of draw what we think this will look like. So let's first take a look at the red, the green, and the blue, because we think those are going to be the full height components of these histograms. We already saw what the red histogram looks like, so I'll give that one to you for free. So it's about 30% of the way we have a spike corresponding to the red column in this image. Now, what other columns will we have? So for green, where should I place the full height spike for green? So 60% of the way. So I'll just divide this roughly in thirds. This is approximate. So that's our green component. What about blue? About 10% of the way. So that's going to be way over here. So we now have three spikes representing the three most prominent colors in this image. Now let's take a look at this fourth column, the two half height colors, white and black. Where will we find the spike? So again, we've already determined that they'll be half height because relative to the maximum spikes, they're half the size. So where will I find the white spike? All the way to the right. So because the luminosity function, again, properly deals with white and black, in fact, all gray, because all of the red, the green, and the blue components will average out, essentially, to the same number. So 255 times 0.3 plus 255 times 0.59 plus 255 times 0.11, and in the end, equals 255. Similarly, for black, we would expect a spike, half-height spike, at the far left. Now it's getting a little bit interesting. We have yellow. So what colors represent yellow, if you might recall? Sorry? Red and green. Yeah, so red and green make up yellow. So what this means is that for our yellow component, we're going to have a 255 value for red, 255 value for green, and a 0 value for blue. So if we were to take our yellow and compute the luminosity for that, which I'll just abbreviate as L, it'll be 255 times 0.3 plus 255 times 0.59 plus 0 times 0.11. So that goes away. So can somebody do this math? What will be the apparent luminosity of yellow? Someone happen to have a calculator up and running? They can do that. Any ideas for our apparent luminosity of yellow? What should this actually be? 227 out of 255. So that's going to be somewhere around here, approximately. OK? So now we have next cyan, which is made up of which two colors? Green and blue. So there's 0 component for red plus a 255 component for green and a 255 component for blue. All right, so again, I'm reliant on you guys for calculators. What would be the apparent luminosity of this half height pixel, or this half height color? Let's think of it a slightly different way. Where do you think, just by looking at it, where do you think it should be relative to yellow? Should it be left of yellow because it looks darker, or should it be right of yellow because it looks brighter? Who thinks left of yellow because it should be darker? One, two, three. All right, who thinks right of yellow because it should be brighter? Okay, one, two, three. Oh man, we're evenly split. In fact, cyan is just slightly left of yellow, something along these lines here. So if we actually look at the resulting luminosity histogram, we can see that we precisely computed what the histogram of this quote-unquote photograph should be. So that's pretty cool. But what if we take this to an even further level? We won't do it now, but somebody had the idea of actually taking a histogram and creating an image out of that histogram. So there's this image here. It has a variety of black and gray tones and white tones. And in fact, one of the things I want to point out, if you look at this gradient of black through gray through white, can you sort of notice that some of the grays are not perfectly gray? They have like a little bit of green tint to them. So you're not going to really notice it if you're looking at necessarily the... Unfortunately, this is a demo that only works here in this room, I would say. But even for those of you at home that are looking at the slides, you might notice on your own computer that when you're looking at these gray tones, they're perhaps not perfectly gray. Like this gray tone looks a little bit green compared to this one, which looks just a little bit purple. Your eyes aren't deceiving you. This is actually a problem with the projector that's not being able to properly display these tones to us. And guess what? We'll get to talk about that at a later date when we talk about color. But anyway, we have this gradient from black all the way up to white. And notice that you can sort of see some grays that seem to be more prevalent than others. It doesn't look like a totally smooth gradient. If you really look at it, like this section right here appears to be kind of large in terms of the grays that are present relative to some of the other sections. And what this histogram actually looks like is really, really cool. It looks like this. So you're able to take an image and generate a histogram out of that image just by placing the proper number of grays, varying the proper number of gray tones so that you get precisely the height at each of the locations that you want to get. It's pretty cool. Perhaps doesn't have a huge practical purpose for us, but this is just kind of goes to show that you can use this same idea to try to compute and make a project like that. All right, so let's come back to what we care about, a little bit more of the reality involving histograms. So we have this then. So as you can probably infer from the way I've been talking, there's more than one type of histogram. You can also sort of tell that there's a channel, it looks like there's a little pull down here in this Photoshop screenshot that says luminosity, but I could perhaps select some other ones. And in fact, you might have looked at some of these other ones and been like, oh, why are these changing? What is going on in each of these different types of histograms? Well, luminosity, again, is the one that uses this luminosity function that determines the apparent brightness of colors based on the colors that are present within the image, and then makes a histogram out of that. But there's other types as well. We could look at the histograms making up the values of the individual channels themselves. So let's say that I have this simplified image. It's just a gradient from white to pure red. And the resulting histograms are those on the right. The luminosity histogram looks sort of crazy like that, but that's perhaps what we would expect, right? We have full height spikes at the red, which is about 30% of the way, and white. And then we have sort of an interesting swoosh of other colors, of other tones that exist between that red and white portion of the histogram. But if we look at the individual color channels, and what this means is that we're asking Photoshop to look at the red component or the green component or the blue component only of all of the pixels within this image, we get these other channels, or we get these other histograms that as a result. So the red one maybe makes sense, but realize what's happening to the pixels in this image. So the pixels on the far left column of this image are white, and we already talked about what white is. It's a full prevalence of red, full prevalence of green, and a full prevalence of blue, which means that everywhere in this image, there is a total presence of red. And that's what we see in the red channel histogram that results from this. But the green and the blue look sort of crazy. It's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. This looks kind of weird now. Now it looks like there is green and blue by looking at these channels, even though there is no green color or blue color in this image. Again, realize that we're combining all of these, and so what we're seeing is that we have some aspects of the image that have absolutely no blue, no green. That's the far right portion of the image, because these pixels only have values of 255 for red, 0 for green, 0 for blue. And then as we move left through this image, we're adding more green and more blue values to make it brighter and brighter and brighter until we get to white. So that's why red we see everywhere. We have red information, so we have a spike in the far right. For green and for blue, we have spikes at 0 and 1 because we have sort of the most pixels at the edges that make up those those values, and we're adding more green and blue in order to add our additional, in order to add the additional brightness to give us the full white value. Sort of imagine what would happen then if we had a gradient that was not white to red, but instead was black to red. How would that change each of these histograms? So let's take a look at the very top histogram, the luminosity histogram, and think about how the histogram would be different for this type of image, a gradient from black to red. What would the histogram look like in this case? So I'll erase our super awesome histogram and replace it with a new one. How would the luminosity histogram look for that image? Right, so rather than start from 30% and shift right, it would start from 30% and shift left, because of the apparent brightness of that would be black to red, or 30% of the way. Now, what would the red channel look like? If we were looking only at the red channel for this same image, again, the red to black, what would the histogram for that look like? The same as this. So if we're going from black to red, remember that there's some pixels that have absolutely no, red. So instead, it would in fact be black all the way to red. So our red channel would look like, in this new image, would look like the green or the blue channels do in this existing image. So what about green and blue? What would those look like? First of all, so what would those look like? Let's think just about the green one for now, to simplify it a little bit. What would the green and the blue channel histograms look like? So a way to think of it is there any green in a gradient from zero to, or from black to red? No, none at all, because it's only pure red, and it goes all, and it fades out to black. So our green channel would have a huge spike in the left. And the blue would be the same, because we have really only the red component. So you can go home and try this out. Bust out Photoshop, use the gradient tool, and look at the histograms and convince yourself that this is actually happening. And try different types of gradients. You can try perhaps green to red and see how that would impact your image. So I actually like that example, now that I just made that up. What would the luminosity histogram for that one look like, from a green to red histogram? So again, luminosity is the apparent brightness. We would have some pixels. I'll get you started. We would have some pixels that are about 30% of the way. We have some pixels that are about 60% of the way. And because it's gradient, it would be kind of like this. So we would have a gradient, a histogram that looks a bit like that. So for the red channel, we don't want to spend too much time on this, but the red channel, because we have some portions of the image that are full on red and then go to no red, look like that. Green would perhaps look the same, and blue would have a spike only in the far left because there's no blue component for this. Making sense so far? Awesome. But that's not all. There's more. So imagine that we have these three separate histograms, and it's not really that useful, perhaps, except in rare circumstances, to look at the individual histograms for the red component, the green component, and the blue component. We already have a luminosity histogram, but as you can tell, that fudges the numbers a little bit. It's only the apparent brightness, but it's perhaps not a true representation of the values that make up the red, the green, and the blue. And there's some other histograms that show this as well. What are they? Let's take a 5-minute break, and when we come back, we'll discuss the remaining histograms. Okay, everyone, welcome back. So hopefully during the break, you had an opportunity to chat, find some group members for Project 3. But before we continue to talk about some histograms, I did actually just want to ask if there's any questions about these things that we've been going over. So I realized that We've been introducing some more equations and talking about numbers again, and I wanted to have this opportunity to see if anybody had any questions or concerns before we move on. I think just to sort of alleviate some concerns at the onset, realize that what matters more is not so much that you memorize this luminosity function, just realize that it exists. And I think it's pretty easy to remember the main takeaway from it, which is that the green is sort of the most valuable component. It is more than twice as important over the next one, which is red, which is three times more important than blue. And if you think of it in terms of that, you can think of it however you want, really, but it's important to realize that if you see a spike in your luminosity histogram, that's about 60% of the way over. That should be a clue to you that what you're looking at is a spike in the greens, perhaps, in your particular image. And so really the main takeaway about all of this discussion is not, again, the numbers, even though the numbers are introduced here because I think it provides a little bit more basis for all of this discussion that we're having, but in fact these concepts that we can take away, like being able to decide what the histogram should look like for these gradients or for these other things, because that, I think, helps inform you about what doing sort of the reverse. When you're actually in a scene, what you're going to see is a histogram and trying to decipher what that histogram actually means and how you should change your photograph as a result. But if there are any questions about this, please do let me know. Now, we've been talking about, before the break, the luminosity function which provides to us this histogram of values from 0 all the way up to 255, which is provided by convention just because the vast majority of our representations are 8-bit or 1-byte, and so that's just a very common thing to have a histogram from 0 to 256 values or 255 values, and a count of all of those values that make up those, which makes up the histogram. We have these separate components, these separate red components, green components, and blue components that each can create histograms of their own, but it's perhaps not that helpful unless we really want to look at these individual color components to look at one at a time. Really what we care about generally with the histogram is a more combined and higher level look at the histogram from our image. So we can combine the red, the green, and the blue channels to create another type of histogram called colors. And generally, the three types of histograms that you're going to use most frequently, perhaps, are the luminosity histogram, the colors histogram, and a separate one called RGB. And this is what those histograms look like for this same image, the same gradient from a pure white to a pure red. We have the luminosity histogram, which is the same as we saw before, but colors is basically just the red, the green, and the blue channels superimposed on top of each other. So you can see that there's some cyan in the middle of this colors component, and the reason for that is that it is what you are looking at is a combination of the green and the blue channel. So a cyan is a signal to you that what you are seeing is that overlap in the histogram is representative of green and blue. So you're seeing all of those green and blue values in that sort of swooping histogram from 0 to 255. And the red is really, you can't really see it, but you'd see like a white pixel in the far right, a combination of all of those colors. Now, RGB is slightly different from colors. Colors is it's a superposition of all of those. You superimpose each of these three channels, one on top of the other, and you actually get the colors channel out, or you get the colors histogram out of that. RGB instead adds all of those values. So it takes the value at 0 for red, adds it to the value at 0 for green, and adds it to the value of 0 at blue, adds all of those together, and that's the new count for that. So essentially what you would expect and what you see in this case is because you have a full height red here, and a full height red for green and a full height red for blue, what you see is a huge spike in the far right of the RGB histogram, and then everything else is flattened. The red, the green, and the blue are flattened as a result. Again, because the height is fixed to the height of the histogram, and so everything else is just relative to that maximum height that you have in your histogram. So generally what you see in a camera are one of two histograms, either luminosity or RGB. And there's no real hard and fast rule of determining which your camera is actually displaying, unless you happen to know, but there are ways that you can figure it out. One you could Google, you can sort of find the specifications, or you could look in the settings of your camera and see if it's possible to change the histogram from one to the next. In general, what you would tend to see is luminosity histograms out of SLRs and RGB histograms out of digital cameras. But this is probably not even true. This was true a couple of years ago. This may not even be true now. Digital cameras, compact cameras may even give you the option of picking one of the two histograms. It's important to realize the distinctions between them. So how then can we actually, or what then can we take away from having these three histograms? So I argue that these are going to be the three histograms that you use the most. So let's take a look at some images with each of those histograms. So in this image, for example, we have a lot of blue, we have a little bit of white. We'd actually seen this image before, but what we looked at was just the luminosity histogram, which is in the upper left-hand corner, the second one in the upper left-hand corner. The RGB one is at the very top, and the colors is at the bottom. So take a look at this, and you can sort of tell the differences between some of these things. You notice, in particular, let me direct your attention to the spikes in the luminosity and the RGB histograms. Let me zoom into this just a little bit. Where's my mouse? Here it is. All right. Oh no, this zoom does not seem to be working. There we go. So we have these two spikes. The bottom one, again, is the luminosity histogram. The top one is the RGB histogram. So why do I have this spike in the far left for the RGB histogram? Why does that spike, is it even right to, so first of all, is it even right to think of this spike as having moved to the right in the luminosity histogram? Not necessarily. What we're looking at in the luminosity histogram, again, is the relative brightness of each of these pixels. What the RGB histogram looks at is the actual values making up the pixels in this image. So in other words, the location of the color matters in luminosity, because we might have a pixel that is a relatively bright blue somewhere in the location of this image, and what we would get out of the luminosity histogram is, in fact, a spike close to blue. And in fact, that's what we're seeing. It's not quite at it's not quite at 10%, this spike, because there are it's not a solid blue. There's some green and there's some red mixed in to make it a little bit brighter compared to the distinct colors that we were looking at in the sample histograms from before. But the apparent brightness of this image is apparently relatively low, because there are large swaths of it that are in fact this blue color. But in the RGB histogram, we don't care about the relative locations of each of these colors. What we are seeing is a huge spike in a loss of color information somewhere in the image. Somewhere in the image, there's perhaps not a lot of blue. Somewhere in the image, there's perhaps not a lot of red, not a lot of green. And we can sort of tell that that might be the case in this particular image. So what's the important thing to take away from this discussion is that there is a distinction between brightness and color that we need to make. What we are looking at with the luminosity histogram is the apparent brightness of the pixels. But that doesn't tell us a lot about the actual values that make up that color information. And that's what the RGB histogram actually shows us. So when we have an image that has more pure color, we're actually going to get very distinct luminance, or rather luminosity, and RGB histograms. If we have some image that's perhaps not quite so colorful, or perhaps, that may not be the right way to say it, that perhaps doesn't have as pure colors, then perhaps those histograms will merge a little bit, but just by chance. So that's one example why I showed this particular image, because there's a lot of blue in it, and as a result, the two histograms seem to have diverged a great deal. But let's take a look at another one, which is even more different. So this is vastly representative of blue, but there is a lot of change in apparent brightness here. there are definitely some dark areas in the scene. There are definitely some overexposed areas in the scene, but predominantly the color that we see is blue. Now, the histograms, I don't want to confuse you by saying that the histogram tells you what color information is actually there. You don't necessarily want to use that for that particular information, but the more important point is that the different histograms are used for different things. So in the luminosity histogram, we can see that we have some areas that are perhaps slightly overexposed in terms of brightness. We have a tonal range in this image that seems to fit relatively well in this dark area, except that there's some pixels that seem to be overexposed. And in fact, we do see that in the image. Overall, it does look relatively dark. There are some areas of very bright regions. So here, for example, where the lights are directly. But when we look at the RGB histogram, we see something different, which is that we have some areas where there are, in fact, values of either red, green, or blue that are extremely bright at 255 or extremely dark at zero. And what this tells you is not necessarily that you have regions that are overexposed, but you have colors, individual colors, that you could think of as being, quote unquote, overexposed. Another thing that you will actually see online a lot is clipped color channels. And what a clipped color channel actually means is that there's probably some blue within this image that is bright enough that we're no longer seeing that information. So one of the main distinctions between the RGB and the luminosity histograms is that the RGB one will do a much better job of showing you when you clip color information. This is very relevant for those of you that like to take pictures of, say, flowers, which tend to be very, very colorful, maybe a very bright red rose, for example, and you really want to capture that color information. If you take a picture of that rose, and it does have very bright reds, the apparent brightness is not going to be that bright to us because of this luminosity function that we defined. So we might actually see that the luminosity histogram would be properly exposed, or it would have all of the tones fit within the middle of that histogram. But we would see perhaps in the RGB histogram that bright red is all the way off to the right. We would see a huge spike in the right. And if you look very carefully at that image, what you should look at in the very bright red regions is to see if you've lost detail in the red portions of that image. Now, in this case, are there some areas that are so completely blue that we are losing some of that color information or some of that information? Well, yes, but unfortunately, there's other colors as well. There's also white. So in this case, this isn't necessarily showing us that individual colors had clipped, but we are seeing that in combination, we have overexposed areas of the image, as we could see in the luminosity histogram. So to recap, what the RGB histogram does a good job of showing you is when you have blown out specific colors, when you've lost details in specific colors, and this is especially important for red and for blue, because the apparent brightness of that is not quite so high, so it won't look to us like it's overexposed, and therefore it may not look like we've lost any information in that. But when you see a huge spike in the far right of your RGB histogram, that's when you should look closely at your image to see those regions that are very bright, that have very true colors, that are very strong individual colors, and see if those areas have lost some detail. And if so, you need to work around that. Do you really care, first of all, about reclaiming that detail? If you're taking a picture of a flower, I would say you do care about getting all the detail in that flower. You don't want to have the petals be so blown out in the red channel that all you see is just a red blob, a red smear, and you lose all of the texture in that flower. You might have to do something like actually underexpose the image, perhaps, or ask your camera to reduce the contrast or to reduce the saturation of that image, to reduce the importance of that color channel, and then later on you can fiddle with it in software. So this is really important to look at these histograms to try to determine what is going on overall in your image. So from these histograms, we can see a couple of things. In the luminosity histogram, we can see that overall, perhaps this is a slightly darker image. And that was kind of my goal, so I would say that that's fine for this image. I didn't want it to be overly bright. I wanted to have it that sort of dark sky, ominous feeling. So this was actually, this met the goal of that particular goal. But in the RGB, we can see that we have some regions that are very dark. We have some pixels that have very low color information. And we have some areas that have a lot of color information. And looking back at it, that was okay for this particular image. There were no details necessarily that were lost to a lot of the bright blue areas. Any questions on this? Okay. Now the colors one, which is generally a histogram that you would find only on your computer, unless you happen to have a relatively high-end camera, though these days more and more cameras do support more and more types of histograms, we do see a lot more information that's useful to us compared to that RGB histogram. We can see, in fact, that if we are losing any color information, if we're clipping any particular channels, it is in fact the blue channel, because that channel is the one that has the huge spike off to the far right. So it is really the deep blue areas that I would want to look at to see if I'm losing any texture, losing any information, because I've blown out that channel. I've clipped that channel, or I've overexposed that color only. The red we can see is not very prevalent, but the green has a nice distribution. And of course the cyan is just a combination of the green and the red, and the yellow is the combination of the red and the green. Yes?
So if you change the white balance on this image to be more yellow, would the actual image look brighter, like the whole image look brighter, and have the same luminosity histogram?
Yes, so if you change, this is an interesting thought experiment. So if we change the white balance of this image, how would that impact our luminosity histogram? Well, yeah, if we are able to introduce more green tones into this, so if we did actually push this a little bit more, a little bit warmer, it would have the appearance of actually changing the brightness, of actually changing the exposure, even though that's not what's happening. What's happening is that our perception of that brightness is what would change. So the luminosity function, or the luminosity histogram, would in fact change, but because we are also changing the color information, the colors in RGB histogram would change as well. But how they change depends on which direction we actually alter the white balance and to what degree we do it. But yeah, they will change. They won't change necessarily at the same amount, but they will change relative to each other. They will change corresponding to the change in white balance that you actually do. Any other questions? All right, so I do want to talk some about this idea that I alluded to a little bit, but really wasn't using the proper term. I talked a little bit about tonal range and to talk about how the tones within a particular image seem to fit relatively well or relatively not well within a scene. In this case, I want to define tonal range a little bit more rigidly, which is the tones that are actually displayed on my image. So we can see that we have a relatively wide tonal range here, but it's not so wide within this image that it extends all the way to white, except that we do have some regions that are overexposed. But it's important to realize that this concept, or the other term that we will talk about, which is dynamic range, is actually really important in our discussion of digital cameras. In particular, the eye does a great job of handling a variation of dynamic range within a scene. This is something that, very much like our visual system impacts the apparent brightness of different colors, our visual system actually impacts how bright the scene looks relative to other portions of the scene. So what do I mean by this? Well, there's never really true black and true white. It's sort of all relative. What our eyes detect is contrast, or the difference between neighboring colors. And this isn't really how a camera works. We'll talk more about what this actually means in terms of cameras a little bit later. But there's a lot of things that actually happen in our eyes. We have our iris that opens and closes automatically. We have the cells within our eyes that respond to the amount of stimulation that they actually receive and try to diminish their response based on overstimulation. They will try to diminish, or perhaps if they're being understimulated, they'll try to become more sensitive. So the immediate sensitivity of the cells within our eyes actually changes for all of the regions within a scene. So that's not to say that everything will then become totally gray, but that we can see scenes that have very high contrast. So for example, if you are outside and it happens to be the middle of the day and it's very bright sunlight, but then you go from inside to outside, there might be a very high change in the intensity of the light, but our eyes adjust relatively well. And so even doing it in a more local context, so rather than moving from inside a building to outside of a building, imagine that you just happen to be standing under a tree and there's a lot of shade in that tree. We can still see very well, even though we may have a lot of reduction in light under that tree compared to what would be outside of that tree in the harsh sunlight. So in other words, our eyes are very good at adapting to the wide array of light intensity that exists in the world. So we can think of this as like an instantaneous dynamic range. So in other words, just by standing right here and looking at one region of the room, which is relatively dark, which is this black desk over here, to a bright region, which might be the ceiling, which has light reflected from the light, I can still see instantaneously all of the details in each of these areas. This is an instantaneous dynamic range that's very wide. We can see these details in these very different areas of intensity of light, and cameras cannot actually do that. This is one of the reasons that when you take an image in a scene with very high contrast, even though you could see it perfectly, all portions of this scene, it appears that there are some regions that are just really overexposed and some regions that are very heavily underexposed. It takes some training to sort of identify what level of dynamic range our cameras would be able to capture, even though we can see it just fine. As you work with cameras a little bit more, you'll start to appreciate that and start to be able to find areas of a scene that can be contained within the camera's possible dynamic range. So if we come back to this idea of instantaneous dynamic range, we really have an enormous variation in our eye. And you think in the bright day, so some of my notes here, in the middle of a bright day, we actually have a 13-stop difference instantaneous dynamic range, which means that we can see something that has a specific amount of light. We can see something that's 13 stops darker, which again is a lot. That's twice as much light, and then twice as much light, and then twice as much light, and then on and on and on 13 times. That's a huge range. And at night, it's a 20-stop difference in instantaneous dynamic range. This is enormous. Now, if we are thinking about the sort of the difference between night and day, if we think about sort of the darkest night to the brightest day, we're really talking about something along the lines of 30 stops or something along those lines. But this is all a dynamic range that is much bigger than what our cameras are capable of capturing. So keep in mind that the important thing here is that our eyes are capable of looking at a scene and getting detail from dark regions and from bright regions because of instantaneous changes that our eyes do on our behalf that our cameras cannot do, because our cameras have uniform exposure across the entire sensor, have uniform exposure through the lens and all of the settings that you set, whereas our eye, in specific regions, can automatically adjust to the amount of brightness and change that apparent dynamic range. So in terms of a digital camera, we have several really good analogies that we can think of to understand this concept of dynamic range. Imagine that you think of light as rain, and rain is falling from the sky, and we want to capture this amount of rain. We want to measure how much rain there actually is. So imagine that there's the sky, and it's pouring rain in some regions. Some regions are pouring more rain than other regions, and this is kind of an analogy for light that's actually entering into a sensor. So we have photons that are entering into our sensor, and we are collecting it at our pixel. We can think of this pixel like a bucket. It's collecting rain, it's collecting photons, it's collecting photons, it's collecting photons. And eventually what's going to happen is that if there's too much, it's going to spill over. And we're not going to be able to tell the difference between when we had filled the bucket to how much additional water there was that had filled the bucket over that. It's a very similar thing with photons and with the pixel within our digital camera. We can collect a certain number of photons, but beyond that, it just overwhelms that pixel. We just cannot capture, cannot measure anything more. And what we see that as is a total overexposure. That pixel is fully white, and there's no texture because of that as a result. And this actually is sort of interesting, because even if we take this a little bit further, this analogy just a little bit further, and think of a sensor as a lot of these buckets just set up in rows and columns, just like a big array of buckets that are sort of close together. And if you're thinking, well, okay, so what would happen is that if it rained too much on one bucket, it would spill over into neighboring buckets. That actually still somewhat holds true in a digital camera as well. It's possible to so overwhelm one pixel that neighboring pixels get impacted as well. This is called blooming. You do actually see it in some of your photographs when some areas are so overexposed. You might have a point source of light that is so overexposed, like, for example, a street lamp in a dark scene, that it actually changes the brightness of the surrounding regions as well. So blooming is actually something that happens, but really we can't take this analogy any farther than that. But this is a good analogy for the way that we can actually think of this. But let's think about the opposite. Rather than collecting a lot of light, what if we don't collect a lot of light? Well, imagine that we're using a ruler, perhaps, to measure how much water we actually have within our bucket. We can really only detect a certain amount of water beyond which we can measure with any certainty. So really, if there's only like a couple of drops in our bucket, we're trying to measure that, what does that mean? We don't really know. We don't really have an understanding of how much water there actually is in this bucket, or in this analogy, how many photons we've actually captured. So there's a minimum amount of signal that we need. There's a minimum amount of rain that has to have fallen, a minimum number of photons that have to have been collected by the sensor in order for us to start registering the differences between them. So really, then, the way that we define dynamic range is very simple. And this is not, again, this is not an equation that we're going to deal with, but it's just the way for you to think about dynamic range and what it actually is. It is the biggest signal that we can collect, our full bucket, the volume of this full bucket, divided by the smallest detectable signal. And that word is important, detectable. We might have a very small signal, but there is, in fact, a lot of things that go into defining what detection actually means. Just like in this bucket analogy, if we think of, well, okay, there's a lot of different ways that we could have errors when we're actually trying to measure a bucket that does not have a lot of rain that's fallen within it. One error is that there's just not enough rain. It's just a couple of drops. So what does that mean when we have kind of a big bucket? How much water has actually fallen? Another thing is, imagine that we have a ruler that is not very precise. It only does it in terms of centimeters or inches or something along those lines, and doesn't have half inches or a quarter inches. So really, then, we can't really tell the difference until we get to that first marker. So there's lots of ways that we can have errors in detecting the smallest possible signal. And that alludes to some of the issues that we have in digital cameras when we're talking about very small signals, very dark areas, and why we get some of these problems that result. And we'll talk more about what that actually means, of course, in the digital camera lectures. But this is really important to consider when we're talking about images, because this means that there is a dynamic range that our camera is capable of capturing. Beyond that dynamic range, even though we may be able to see it, our camera is not going to be able to capture it. There will be some areas of the image that just do not provide enough rain, do not provide enough photons to create a signal that we can detect. There's going to be some areas that are going to provide so much that we can't tell the difference between it. So this is just a slightly more technical definition of these areas that we've been talking about, overexposed and underexposed areas within our scene. Now, the number of stops of dynamic range that our cameras can actually produce varies wildly. Just a few years ago, during the same lecture, I would have said that a digital SLR would maybe have 10 stops of dynamic range, which is pretty good. That's a pretty good dynamic range. Non-digital SLRs like compact cameras would have something like 5 or 6 stops of dynamic range, and worse for camera phones. But these days, we're seeing better performance out of all of these devices. Digital SLRs have somewhat stagnated. I think we can see maybe, I'm sort of guessing, around 13 or 14 stops of dynamic range, perhaps out of the best ones, perhaps better. But the other cameras, the technology for the smaller cameras have started to catch up. So the most recent phones that have come out, not only from Apple, but from other manufacturers as well, have really improved the dynamic range. And that's one of the best ways of being able to improve the quality of the image, because we can now capture regions of the scene that before were previously totally undetectable. Imagine that I had taken the same picture with a camera that did not have the same dynamic range as this camera. What would happen is that we would see more loss of detail in the bright regions of the image. We would see more loss of detail in the dark regions of the image. And what this would look very low quality to us. It would look as though there was a lot of really dark regions and a lot of really bright regions, and very little was actually properly exposed. But by having this camera that can support a large dynamic range, we then have a lot more latitude within our file to be able to modify that and to be able to display the image in a much more natural way. So why, I sort of alluded before, that digital SLRs have better dynamic range compared to their smaller brethren, including camera phones and compact cameras and these sorts of things. Think about why that might be. But the reason we're not going to get a chance to talk about for another couple of weeks when we talk about the digital camera lecture. But this is, in fact, an important takeaway. And that's histograms. There's a lot to it, right? It's sort of surprising, I think, when we actually start talking about it, all of the various things that we can talk about. The last few minutes of class, just like we have done in the past, I want to do a critique of an image, which this time Henry has very kindly allowed us to show his image. Henry, would you mind coming up to describe your image for us? And it is, in fact, this one. So I'll turn this on.
So for project 2, I made my own tilt shift lens, and actually I made 2. This is the second. This is the result of the second. So I started out as a photographer doing street photography, and doing a lot of street candids. And so I went out the sun came out the other day in Cambridge, and this woman, actually what I first noticed was the light coming through the cigarette, and she was very frail and sort of shaky, and I think she might have been homeless, but I didn't want to ask her or interrupt what was going on, because this was sort of a very, there seemed to be a very beautiful moment with the light hitting her, and so I sort of found a location where I could take the picture and not interrupt her and not sort of invade her space. And then luckily for me, she just turned her head just slightly that I could catch her profile. And the smoke was still coming through from the sun at the angle. So a couple adjustments that I made were, one is I cropped a lot of this photo. There's a street scene in the back, but I felt it didn't provide the information I wanted. I mean, it gave you a sense of context, of place, but it wasn't important in terms of what was happening. To my advantage was that the second tilt shift I designed could let me control the aperture, which allowed me to then actually control more of the focus that I wanted. So I could point to her face and somewhat control it a little better than my first lens. If anyone's tried it, it's kind of tricky. You have to sort of move it in and out and tilt it up and down until you get to where you want. So what that also did was it really diffused the area, and surrounding her so that she was more highlighted. And then in post-production, I went in and kind of brought out some of the light. I looked at this is almost a sort of drawing. So I went in and I dodged some of the light just to bring out the line of light on her back and a little bit on the smoke. And then sort of in the background, because there was just a few details that were bothering me, I burned then some you could see up in the corner there's a little wheel, but it's just enough that I was okay with that there, but I burned a little bit out. So, and then I added a grain to it I wanted that kind of grit. Though I've gone back and looked at this without the grain, and I actually think it works better than with the grain. So I think that's the one change I would make. So anyway, I think
that's really fascinating, because I really like the grain, actually. I think it really goes well with this sort of, it has this feel of the film days. There's something about the quality of the lens itself, which really gives this, there is this softness to it that's prevalent everywhere except on the woman's face. And it really does have like a film feel to it, which I think is neat. Granted, I haven't seen it without the added noise, so it's hard to know like what it would look like without it. But I was going to say that I really like that sort of feel to it. And if you don't mind me using it as an example, I presume this was an older lens that you had used as part of your construction.
Mm-hmm.
So if we actually look at, if we can go back to a couple of lectures ago and look at the bokeh here, we can see a couple of things, which is that the aperture is hexagonal, but also that it does have like a little bit of that halo mm-hmm. around that, which is actually pretty neat, I think, in this image, especially the pattern that it makes. It's almost like you're watching it's almost like you're seeing something orbit around something else, like it's some sort of a satellite or something along those lines. But I think this really helps give it that feel, that sort of old school feel that we might get from older ones. But yeah, I just did want to point that out. But this is fantastic. Are there comments from others on this particular image, especially perhaps around this noise? Because I found that to be a very interesting takeaway. John.
So a couple people from Skype had a few questions. So you use the terms dodge and burn, and we haven't talked about that yet. So I was wondering if you just quickly describe what that did. You need the mic.
So it's funny because you were explaining tonight about the cones. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the same idea where your eyes adjust to different sort of exposures. So in essence, I treat the image the same way. So if I want this to be brighter, I take there's in Lightroom. Let me backtrack. In film, dodging and burning, you actually blocked or allowed more light to hit the film itself, the actual print, when you exposed it. Since this isn't film, what you do is you take a brush and you highlight an area, and then you go in and you say, expose this more. So that would be dodging. So dodging does not expose. I'm not explaining this well. Dodging allows an area to be brighter, where burning allows an area to get darker. That's, I think, a burnt wood is dark, so burning is darker. That's my little mnemonic. I'm not sure if I'm explaining it well, but
no, it does.
It
so yeah,
comes
so
just from film terminology.
Yeah, just to fill in like some of those details. So back in the film days, in the dark room, whatever, you would have your negative print. That would be you would focus some light through it and through a lens mechanism or whatever, and you would have some photosensitive paper. And the amount of time that you expose that light through the negative to that paper results in the sort of the final exposure of the print. And you could use dodging and burning came from that idea of basically shining the light for a longer amount of time or for a reduced amount of time to try to even out the dynamic range of that image. So you could sort of fake it. You could take like even your hand and just kind of quickly move it across to reduce the amount of light that fell under that portion of the image. And now we have carried over the same terminology into digital realm, and dodge and burn is just carry over from that, from those days.
Yeah, and I use Lightroom, so in Lightroom there's a little brush tool under the Develop tab, and in it you sort of mark the area you want, and then you can adjust the certain exposure, temperature, things of that nature. You can also pick presets that say darken or lighten, so that helps.
Yeah, so practically for us, what this means is that rather than change the exposure for the entirety of the image, we can selectively change the exposure for portions of it by basically just painting or brushing regions of the image that we want to be lighter or darker, depending on the tool that we use.
So there's a lot of praise for this photo on Skype with the group over there. They asked if you actually have any black and white film photography experience or if you have any darkroom experience, because they've noticed a pattern in your photography that you seem to have an eye for this.
I do have a little bit of film experience, and I hate to say this, in high school I was in the yearbook, and back then we used film, and then in college I did a little bit of black and white. Never got into color processing, but yes. And what I like about black and white, and I mean about working in digital as opposed to, I like film. But what I like is there's more control in terms of drawing than there was in film, because I can actually pick very specific areas now and control the actual amount. So my background is drawing, and so that's also part of what informs what I do.
Actually, one of the things we will be talking about later is how we can create really different forms of black and white images from the color information that's provided in our images. So even just today, we alluded to it a little bit when we were talking about, well, what's sort of the most naive way of taking color and making it black and white? Well, we could average it, but there's lots of other ways that we could do the same thing. And you can get really striking results when you consider these many different things. Anybody else here happen to have any critique for Henry before we wrap up? Yeah.
I just wanted to say that I think this is like a really atypical use case for a tilt shift lens, but I was impressed that you seemed to be able to use it to your advantage to really focus on the element that was most important in this image and to kind of blow everything out into this smooth and creamy blur and really just get the viewer's focus on what you saw in the scene at that moment, which was the smoke around the woman's face, which I think is really cool, and it's not something that you would normally use a tilt shift lens for, so kind of neat.
I just want to say I apologize that the screen went black. Apparently my computer went to sleep for just a brief moment. Thank you. Yes.
What time of day did you take this photo? You said it was during the day, right?
Yeah. you can feel free to sit down if you want to stand up here.
It was in the morning. So this was probably around 8 a.m. Of course, if it were the summer, it would be a lot earlier. So I lucked out. It was just the right time. I have to say, though, that the one thing about in the last year, I was sort of stuck. And what's been great about the tilt shift, and you remarked on it, Rob, is that it's given me sort of a freedom to sort of approach photography like I first did when I would go out. And so that's been a real sort of new joy and sort of a way of looking at things with fresh eyes, so to speak. So I really enjoyed the process that has given me.
That's awesome. It's amazing what a fresh perspective can do. Like, it really reinvigorates the creative juices. Agree with that. Great. Thank you all very much. And if you, of course, would like to show one of your own images during lecture or even during section, please do email it to staff@dme10.org. For those of you that are at a distance, we also would like to invite you to participate, of course, in this. Basically, what we'll do is show the image and then ask you to record it on your smartphone or whatever, just 30 seconds or so of describing it. And although it will be hard for us to ask you questions unless you're able to participate in the live stream, we'll still have some takeaways that we'll be able to discuss here in class for that. And so with that, I want to thank you all very much for coming. We'll see you again next week. Have a great weekend.